The death of 22-year-old Vernell Bing Jr. sparks renewed calls for independent oversight of the JSO. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show video on demand with our partner TVJax.com. And just ahead, should the Justice Department investigate the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office over controversial shooting incidents? Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, it's called Hands-Only CPR, and it can save lives. We'll tell you about it, plus a conversation with the local entrepreneur known as the Millionista Mentor. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, the police shooting death of Vernell Bing Jr. continues to provoke outrage. Across many neighborhoods in Jacksonville, the incident has sparked long-standing tensions between African-American citizens of this community and the police. This at a time when Sheriff Mike Williams says he wants to focus his agency on improving relations in the neighborhoods most angry with the police force. The 22-year-old Bing, who was unarmed, apparently died on May 22nd after he rammed a stolen Chevy Camaro head-on into a braking patrol car at 50 miles an hour, ending a high-speed chase at a Springfield street corner. The officer involved, Tyler Landreville, fired five times at Bing after he refused to comply with Landreville's commands, police say. Protests and pressure have been constant since Bing's death, with local groups calling for an independent review of the JSO incident and the JSO generally, and even a Justice Department investigation. Ben Frazier is with the local chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and joins us now with more about the SCLC's position on this, and good morning.
Good morning to you.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and comments as protests mount after the shooting death of Vernell Bing Jr. in Jacksonville? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on our Facebook page. And let me begin by saying we did reach out to Sheriff Mike Williams and to to invite him on the program. And he has declined until the review of the shooting is concluded. So Ben Frazier with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Well, there you have it. He can't come on the show until after the investigation. He can't say anything, nothing at all, not one word, not a sentence, not a word of assurance to the people of Jacksonville that what they're going to get is an honest and thorough investigation. Come on, Sheriff. He's playing us.
Why now? Let me ask you as an impartial questioner of this.
Sure.
The SCLC and the NAACP in particular have called for the Justice Department to investigate the shooting of Vernell Bing Jr. Let's go over what we know about this, which we don't know a lot. We have a little bit of information. What we know is that there was no weapon found on this man. We know that there was a high-speed chase that concluded with Bing's car ramming into the police car.
Hold it. Let's not be so rushed to judgment with whether it was a ram or whether it was a collision.
Right.
Because to say the word ram implies and infers that this gentleman used his car as a weapon. We don't know that yet. He was running away from the police. We know that. There's no question about that. 53 miles per hour. The police department says there's nothing to indicate that there was braking involved. Well, that's the way collisions occur. There's no braking. But the question is, did he simply turn a corner and run into the cop who was trying to stop him? Did the officer use his weapon to roadblock this gentleman? What I'm suggesting is, let us not rush to judgment and say, because the investigation has not come back yet with results, that he used his car as a weapon. Mm-hmm. You can't say that.
What are your thoughts about the fact that this incident has come on the heels of many others over the decades in Jacksonville, which have fostered a climate of distrust, particularly in African-American neighborhoods, when it comes to relationships with the police? Periodically over the years, groups such as yours have said we need an independent civilian review board to investigate these incidents because residents don't trust the police investigation. The sheriff has said he does not think that's necessary, but that he would like to open up the internal process that they're conducting to the public. A police union lawsuit closed that process 6 years ago. What do you think about that?
If you're talking about the issue of the outside agency review, we believe and support the idea of an outside agency review. Now, relatively few sheriff's offices and, should we say, city police departments have what's referred to as the officer-involved shooting agreements with the FDLE. It's called a memorandum of understanding, which would allow the FDLE to investigate. By the way, they've got 73 additional personnel to do just that. The budget is in place for FDLE to do that. All the sheriff has to do is say okay. But what the sheriff wants instead, quite simply speaking, is to continue his internal investigations. Well, we say you keep doing the same investigations and you keep coming up with the same results. And of every shooting ever been involved in Duval County, no police officer has ever been called as having been involved in an unjustified shooting. So what we keep demanding is the same investigation, and we keep getting the same results. And I think that's the definition for insanity.
In fact, your organization studied public records showing that over the last decade or so, there have been 135 police shootings in Jacksonville. 65% of those killed by a police bullet were African American.
Horrendous. Those same statistics are the kind of statistics that the Justice Department came up with post-Ferguson when they looked at the disparities in policing of the white and black communities in Ferguson, Missouri. If you did the same investigation of this department, you would come up with the same results, and you would find that there are horrendous disparities in police stops of black people in this town. We know for a fact that there is a history of JSO police brutality, a history of high profiling. We know there's a history of questionable police shootings. We know there's a history of questionable police shootings that resulted in the deaths of black people. It's crazy. We recognize this. We need to stop. I want to make this the nice way, but we're just playing here. We need to take an honest look at what's going on with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Department. I assure you, if we're not careful, we will be the epicenter of a new national movement that I'm hopeful won't result in violence, but certainly it will result in the attention being focused on Jacksonville if this investigation shows results that are inconsistent with eyewitness accounts.
Let's talk about the eyewitness accounts. They have not all matched up and aligned. What do we know from the eyewitness accounts?
We know from the people that I've talked with personally that the gentleman, Vernell Bing Jr., apparently was unarmed. We know that he exited from the passenger side of the vehicle, that he was apparently injured and limping away from the scene and the police officer, that they say he didn't appear to have posed any threat, was not digging in his pockets, was not doing anything in a threatening manner. Now, there's some question about whether the officer gave verbal commands or not. I think that the JSO is saying that he made some kind of verbal demands. They won't tell us what he said, but eyewitness accounts don't agree with that the officer gave any verbal accounts. He shot 5 shots, we know that. Only 1 shot, according to the JSO, actually hit the gentleman in his left temple. But if he was walking away from and not being a threat to the police officer, why did he unholster his weapon and shoot? So far, JSO says something happened. That's what the spokesperson said. The sheriff says for reason unknown to us. Nobody knows why this man pulled his weapon. He did make a statement, however, mm-hmm. to state attorney's office investigators.
Now, as we wait for the results of the sheriff's office investigation, what are your thoughts about Sheriff Williams' efforts to, in his words, increase transparency? He has started what he calls a Sheriff's Initiative. It's a study of police policies, panels made up of local citizens and advocates. That report is expected out by the end of the month. He's addressed the issue of body cameras, saying he's not opposed to them, but that they are expensive and that there has to be a way to pay for them. What's your response to all of that?
Well, let's take the body cam issue on head on. Quite frankly speaking, I think there's already a consensus on the part of most people in Jacksonville, regardless of the color of their skins or the walk in their economic life. I think there's a consensus for the three things that SCLC stands for. I think there's agreement on the Citizens Advisory Board idea. We need that to, foster some degree of accountability and trust. There's agreement on the body cam idea. There's agreement on the outside agency review. As it relates to the body cam idea, the sheriff has vacillated. He's moved from his opposition to body cams to now saying, oh no, I'm for them now, but I don't have any money. Well, he's got millions of dollars for other weapons, Glocks and whatever else. He simply needs to make body cam acquisition, purchase, deployment, maintenance, and sustainability a part of his budget. It needs to be a line item, and if he can't work it out that way, he needs to get some creative financing together. He needs to ask for the help from the private sector. We need to put our heads together. Sheriff, guess what? Body cam's not free. You got to pay for them. So just get creative and start working on the process with the council and the mayor and work it out.
And let's go to your calls right now as we speak with Ben Frazier of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference amid calls for independent oversight of the JSO. Sheriff Mike Williams has declined to appear on this program to discuss this issue, he says, until the review is concluded, but we have made that request. Let's go to your calls. What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Larry in Murray Hill. Go ahead, Larry.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Mr. Frazier, for being there. I simply want to say this, that when it comes to accountability for the JSO, there has been very little in my 14 years of experience in this town, and there is a definite suspicion of JSO by the African-American community. And to say that it's not justified is really overlooking what needs to be addressed here. But if the JSO has nothing to hide, then why can't we have this federal investigation and get to the bottom of this and start moving towards justice? It seems like all we're doing is making excuses for something that needs to happen and should have happened a very long time ago. I thank you for taking my calls, and I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, thanks, Larry.
I think Larry is correct. I want to continue to stress, however, I don't think this issue is as black and white as some of us want it to be. I think it's pretty clear that something happened that was pretty strange, and in the very least, this police-involved shooting is, in fact, questionable. I think that it leaves most of us with an uneasy feeling. I don't believe the people of this community are ready to go through a whole bunch of hullabaloo, a whole bunch of headbutting, and all we want, all of us, each of us, is an honest and thorough investigation. I don't think that's asking for too much. And when the sheriff says he stands for transparency and then turns down an invitation to even come on a radio station like this in the sake of the best interest of the public, it's horrendous. You think we're buying that? That's garbage.
Well, and to be clear, he said he will talk about it, but not until they've concluded the investigation.
He's not talking about it when we need to talk about it. He needs to assure us. What's at stake here is the reputation of his office.
Well, let me ask you, Ben, this shooting review that's going on now will look at whether the officer's action was justified. And by law, police are justified in shooting a fleeing suspect if they are considered a substantial risk to the officer's life or to others' lives.
Precisely.
So that is the standard.
That's the standard. And as I said before, the big question that this whole thing revolves around is the officer's account versus what the eyewitnesses say. That's what this is all about, because they're saying he was walking or limping away from. That's what two eyewitnesses have said, walking away from, that he did not pose a threat. And as he walked away, he fired shots. So if he was a threat to somebody else, the biggest threat would appear would be the police officers missed shots because he fired five shots. Only one hit this guy. Where did other shots go? I mean, those shots may have been the greatest threat to anybody else around there.
All right, let's go to a lot of your calls on this topic. Larry in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Larry.
Hey, good morning. I would just like to say I brought this up to Sheriff Ruskin, but he got nowhere. And the police department, the sheriff's office, needs to understand there will never be any really good rapport with the minority community unless they go to a private review board. I mean, a citizens review board. And what my suggestion to him was this, and I've talked to a couple of senior judges. There are many senior and retired judges in this community, judges that sat on the bench for many years, who would serve on a review board to either five or three or however you want to do it. And until that's done, you will never have any real headway with the minority community or anybody. I'm not making a judgment on this particular case. I don't know enough of the information, but I don't trust anybody, whether it's a sheriff's office or whoever it is, policing their own people. I think it's not right. I don't think we do it in other situations, and this is certainly one that could be easily corrected. That's all I got to say.
Okay, thanks, Larry. And now here, Ben, is another point of view. Scott emails the show. Mm-hmm. If you were a police officer and a car you were pursuing collided into you, and then you and he got out of your cars and you called out to tell the person to stop and he didn't, wouldn't you fire your pistol at him? If a police officer tells me to stop and I don't, the officer has every right to fire. That's Scott on the South Side.
Well, Scott, your statement, I understand where you're coming from. It's filled, however, with, if I counted them right, maybe if four times. They taught me that the word if, two letters, is actually the world's largest word. If. We don't know. We've got to find out what happened. Let's not play the if game. Let's not rush to judgment. Let's find out what happened, and that's what we're demanding. We're not trying to justify or say that the officers should not. We're simply saying we want results. After all things are said and done, with all things considered, we're asking in our collective voice, our collective directive from the community is, tell us what happened. Tell us what really happened. Tell us the truth, and tell us as soon as you can.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page. It's clear that not just in Jacksonville, but nationwide, that the police could benefit from more thorough and diverse training in de-escalation and conflict resolution. Now, when it comes to that piece of it, that's come up a lot, not just locally, but that's been a point of discussion with a number of these flashpoint incidents all over the country.
You're right.
Whether it's Ferguson, Missouri, or the man that died in Staten Island when he was selling loose cigarettes, Freddie Gray in Baltimore. There have been a bunch of these incidents. What are your thoughts about police looking at increased emphasis on peaceful conflict resolution?
We need to give them the training that they need. So much of what revolves around this issue is a lack of diversity training. And we're up against a culture. It's not black and it's not white. We stand against, however, a police culture that embraces gender and racial stereotypes. We stand against a police culture that by its actions discriminate against the citizen on the basis of the color of their skin. We stand against that culture, and we need to have diversity training that allows them to maybe understand the way some people operate and the way others operate.
Here's another email from Will in Springfield, and he says, I live near the intersection where this incident took place. Most neighbors are just happy that this career criminal didn't hurt any innocent bystanders or police with his dangerous behavior while passing through. Video exists from the incident that discredits many eyewitness accounts, which JSO has been given. Choices have consequences. If you participate in a criminal lifestyle, you put yourself at risk for negative outcomes.
Certainly, we understand that. But like most adults, we recognize there's a need for laws. Like most adults, we recognize the need for law enforcement. What we will not stand for is public executions because of a person's criminal background.
Mark,
this is not the Wild Wild West.
Mark on the West Side. Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you. I really want to fault the sheriff. You know, I think most forward-looking cities of any size have come to the conclusion that it serves no one, certainly not the police department or the individual police officers, in holding back this information. I was listening to National Public Radio just the other day. I believe there was a city out west that there were a couple of incidents happened right in a row, and they had the dashboard cams and the body cams on the news the next day with the sheriff talking about them. This sort of, you know, well, we're trying to, you know, dot all our I's and cross all our T's makes it look like they are sort of trying to, you know, come to a story. And I just wish he would, you know, just come, you know, you could show that dashboard cam where this guy rammed his police car and said, you know. So body cams, too, that's interesting as well. Everybody says they want them, and it's probably a good idea. But what happens if, you know, I have some little incident, and I involve the police, and the police come over, and then they're, you know, whatever it is, and then there my pictures and my words and my actions are all over the 6 o'clock news that night. You know, do I want, I mean, you know, I'm a law-abiding citizen, but things happen, and do I want that, or do they ask my permission? Do I have to sign a waiver? I mean, that's I don't know the answers to those questions.
All right, Mark. Suri in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Suri. What do you think?
I'm sorry, hello?
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to make the comment that occasionally police will call out to someone, and depending on situations, you know, this particular person might have been disoriented. You know, if they crashed in a vehicle getting out, there's possibilities that they did not hear, you know, or they're disoriented. There's a number of possibilities, but I do believe that there's too many people that are trigger happy. And I am part of the Moms Demand Action here in Florida. And so that, you know, I'm not taking sides. I'm just saying that I really think there's a different way that we could approach things. And, like I said, too many people are trigger happy. So
you mean non-lethal force?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we see it in Great Britain. It's working great. People there, the police don't have weapons, and somehow it's effective.
All right, thanks for the call. Here's a tweet from Kingsley. Whatever happened to non-lethal force? Is it fists or pistols only? That said, the JSO will make the argument that officers need to be armed to protect themselves and to protect the community.
They're not aiming for legs. That's not the way they're trained. It just doesn't happen that way. They shoot the kill shot, and that's what they did in this instance. And the question, probably more appropriately, is whether the officer was disoriented. That could certainly be a part of the equation in terms of why he pulled his weapon, because so far we have heard no credible reason as to why the weapon was pulled to begin with. No one that stood and said, hey, listen, that guy threatened that police officer. Nobody's saying that. There's no reason for any person to stand up and just tell a lie. Nobody gets paid for lying. All they want to know is what happened.
Well, it's interesting to get the email from the listener in Springfield that there is video. Someone shot video of this incident, which may reveal more information than we know
now. Certainly, we'll only watch that we could get video on this. That is very good. I hope that it does, in fact, exist. Because what we want is truth. We keep asking questions. They keep telling us to wait. Yes, we have questions. Yes, we want answers. No, we don't trust them. And we're wondering what's taking so long. And it is an old saying that justice delayed is justice denied.
Mark on the South Side. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. I mean, I would like to just point out that everybody in the nation knows exactly what is going on here. And for anybody, regardless of their race, especially your black guests, to stand up there and say that this is not a black or a white issue, it's just exaggerating the issue. I mean, let's look at the situation. I mean, even all the black officers that happened to Freddie Gray in Baltimore, we know that the reason why black men are treated the way they're treated goes back almost 300 years. You cannot erase the fact of race from American society, no matter how hard you try to. And it's just ridiculous for anybody to stand up and say that white police officers murdering, gunning down black men in the streets of America has nothing to do with race.
No, sir. You're absolutely correct. I agree with you. However, what I'm talking about is a police culture, and that is something that clearly has to be addressed, because there are black officers and white police officers, and what we're talking about is a police culture that treats some people differently than others, based purely on the color of their skin.
And now, of course, this whole discussion sparks strong emotions and very divergent opinions. We've heard from both sides from our listeners this morning, and I appreciate all the feedback. All of this said, will you continue your request that the Justice Department investigate this incident?
Most definitely. This clearly is a case and a need for outside investigation. We do not trust the JSO. Quite frankly speaking, many do not trust the state attorney's office. There's a need for a citizens advisory board. There's a need for the body cam deployment. And, of course, there's a need for the outside agency review. We, as an organization at SCLC, stand for those three things. And we call upon all the citizens of Jacksonville, regardless of the color of their skins, to stand up, particularly members of the household of faith. You should be standing up for justice and against inequality.
Well, as I mentioned, we do hope to host the sheriff on this at some point. In the meantime, Ben Frazier, representing the local chapter of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, much more still ahead. Later, a preview of the new show at Theater Jax, also the Million Easter Mentor. But up next, an incredible story of a life saved, despite very long odds, out on the beach. All about hands-only CPR and why you need to learn it. That's coming up next.
I'm Steve Woodard, the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the City of Jacksonville. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical to your safety. Listen to emergency management for important evacuation information. Stay informed at jacksready.com and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
I'm Nancy Bronner of the One Jax Institute.
And I'm Kyle Reese of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church.
Join us for WJCT's quarterly program, Faith Matters.
On each installment, we'll explore today's most pressing issues through the lens of faith.
That's Faith Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
In Texas, demand for the abortion pill is growing. Since the FDA changed its label and loosened restrictions, more women are avoiding strict state restrictions on surgical abortions.
A lot of times you don't want too many people knowing what's going on. With the pill, I feel like it's more kind of to yourself.
The state of abortion in Texas, next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative that provides a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society. Tune in to the PBS NewsHour weeknights at 7 on WJCT-TV for compelling stories of individuals and organizations addressing such issues. And log on to chasingthedreamproject.org. Funding for this initiative is provided by the JPB Foundation and Ford Foundation. Local funding provided by Wells Fargo.
Welcome back. Well, this week is CPR Week. It's a time set aside to spotlight how we can save more lives if we learn how to administer CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and in particular, a technique called hands-only CPR. Now, one local survivor of cardiac arrest has an incredible story to share about all this. He's CPR survivor J.R. Bourne. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Also with us, Jill Henderson, Mayo Clinic CPR advocate and clinical nurse educator. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
And in a moment, Jill will share with us a little bit more about hands-only CPR. But first, JR, you're a marketing executive with the PGA Tour, young, healthy guy.
Yeah.
How old are you, by the way?
41 now.
Young guy still, yeah.
Less than a year ago.
What happened? You were less than a year ago, you're out at the beach.
Yeah, I was in Jacksonville Beach kicking the soccer ball with my friend. And, you know, no signs of anything that morning, normal morning. And turned away from the beach. And simply just kind of the lights went out and just went down.
You collapsed.
Collapsed. Next thing I knew, I was hearing, you know, we have a pulse. Oh, wait, we don't have a pulse. And then I went and was shocked twice. So I was shocked by an AED after being revived with, you know, CPR first. So CPR and AED really what saved me on the beach that day.
The external defibrillator.
Yes.
And EMTs got to you lickety-split.
Yeah, I mean, there was a woman doing yoga about 500 yards from me on the beach. My friend was with me. He yelled for help, and she came right over. She was CPR certified and began CPR probably within the first minute of me being down. And then within another 2 minutes, the lifeguards were there on the scene to, you know, help kind of take over.
And it was that speedy intervention, you think, that made the difference?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, you know, I've had neurologists at Mayo Clinic tell me that without that instant timing, I could have neurological permanent damage.
Wow. So you went into surgery, you recovered, and you've been diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Yes.
An inherited condition.
I have some...
Right?
Not necessarily. No. Yeah, I have some history on my father's side of heart attacks in their 50s, but nothing as young as this. And what I've been told from the doctors is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is, you know, 50% of the time they don't know exactly why that happens. So I'm kind of in that electrical issues in my body. I have no, you know, blockage or issues of blockage in my heart necessarily, but my electrical circuits might be off. So
okay. And as you continue to manage that, Jill Henderson, you are the clinical nurse educator and CPR advocate with Mayo Clinic. It is CPR week. So JR's story is a really important and kind of harrowing one to tell, because people that knew CPR were right there. That made all the difference.
And that's what we hope for this week, and all of the training that we're doing for hands-only CPR, is that there's a helpless feeling if you don't know what to do and somebody goes down. And we're trying to have less helpless people in the community where they learn hands-only CPR.
What is hands-only CPR?
Well, 5 years ago when we did some changes in the AHA guidelines, we put circulation first. So hands-only took the breathing out of the equation for civilian bystanders.
Not blowing into someone's mouth.
Not blowing into somebody's mouth. If you were somewhere and somebody was laying down and you thought you had to do both and you didn't want to put your mouth on theirs, you didn't do anything. So by taking that off the table, we got more people doing more things, more compressions, and that saved the lives.
And is that how you were helped,
I believe,
JR?
So, Melissa.
They
I'm
did
not
hands
sure,
only.
Actually, yeah.
You don't. Yeah, you weren't. You probably weren't fully aware. But so hands-only CPR is something anyone can learn how to do.
Correct.
And you're even offering a free event about this. Can
yes,
you tell
we
us
are.
About it?
This Saturday, the Healthy Family Training Camp is at the Farmers Market on Beaver Street from 10 to 2. The American Heart Association has a table. I'll be there doing some teaching. It doesn't take long to learn. Anybody can learn. I've taught young people, old people, seniors. Anybody can do it, and you just have a feeling of, I could respond in an emergency. And it's important to know. It's a feeling of control. That
sure.
You can do something.
Yeah, of being empowered to help others. Now, JR, you're also passionate about laws involving access to AEDs. Those are the defibrillators
Correct.
That are used to help someone who's
yeah.
in the throes of cardiac arrest.
Yeah, I mean, I've replayed this incident in my head, obviously, many times in the last year. And really, it was a day of divine intervention and really flawless medical execution. And being on the beach at 10:30 when lifeguards, you know, start their volunteer service at 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, what's the chances? I don't go Saturday mornings to the beach every day that late. So, you know, without the AED being there, that was really what really did revive me. So, you know, learning how to use AEDs, they should be everywhere. I mean, they should be as common as a fire extinguisher, really, is what yeah. where they should be in our society.
And there's a movement to make that happen, isn't there? That's
absolutely.
Yeah, and you're part of that now.
Absolutely.
Well, and by the way, kudos to the all-volunteer Jacksonville Beach Life Saving Corps. They've been around for a century.
They have. They
and
have
they just prove how great they are time and time again, with your case being the most recent one.
Absolutely. Yeah, they've become an important group in my life as well since being saved by them. So,
Jill, you want everyone to come on out to the Beaver Street Farmers Market this Saturday.
This Saturday,
all day. Free event.
Free event. It's for healthy families so that we can teach moms, dads, older children, younger children to understand, recognize, and have something they can do to help. And hands only is pretty simple. You can learn it in 2 to 5 minutes. It doesn't take a long course. There's online YouTube videos. If you just type in hands-only CPR, you could have a clue where to push, how fast to push. It doesn't take a lot of medical training to do this and be good at it. Mm-hmm. And if you can keep the blood moving, keep the heart and brain alive till the AED comes or advanced care, that gives the person the best chance for survival.
Absolutely. And it is CPR week. So look it up online or come on out to this free healthy family event Saturday at the Beaver Street Farmers Market. Thanks so much for being with us. CPR survivor J.R. Bourne and Mayo Clinic's Jill Henderson. Thanks for sharing this.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
We're back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, how shortages of everything from toilet paper to antibiotics, electricity, and cash is creating a crisis for Venezuela, whose economy was built on oil until oil prices plummeted. We talk with Nicholas Casey, the New York Times Andes bureau chief, who will also tell us about his trip inside a camp for fighters from FARC, the Colombian guerrilla movement. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT's Great Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through June 13th at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
This week on All Things Considered, we investigate the VA's Veterans Choice Program. It was supposed to get vets health care more quickly, but vets and providers are still frustrated by delays.
What I'm worried about is what happens to the veterans who can't handle it.
Can't handle the paperwork.
They just don't have the internal resources to put up with it, and so they throw up their hands and they give up. And they don't get care.
We find out why vets are still waiting. Listen to All Things Considered every afternoon.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, September 17th, Hyatt Hotel. The day will include great national and local speakers that will inspire and empower you to live your life to the fullest. Tickets are $40. Do not miss out. Log on to WJCT.org/Girls Day Out.
Welcome back. Well, she's known as the Millionista Mentor. Stephanie Nikolic went from being $100,000 in debt to running a very successful business. This global entrepreneur and coach is the latest speaker to appear at the St. Augustine's popular Women's Wednesday speaker series. Her talk is coming up tonight in historic St. Augustine. But we've got a preview right now as we welcome the Millionista Mentor to Studio 5. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How'd you get that nickname?
I made it up.
Okay, very good. Excellent. You gave yourself that name. Yeah. What does it stand for?
When I created it, I kind of fell into becoming a mentor, but it really meant like taking the ordinary and giving people the extraordinary and really trading that in. Because I work with women predominantly and I had struggled with a lot of my own stuff. So it was like, no dream is too big, right? So you can have whatever you want in life. Just go for it.
And you've lived that, but after a lot of struggle. You were working at a company, left that job, and decided to start your own business?
Yeah. So I thought this was a great idea. I would start my own company, and if I could grow this very successful business for somebody else in corporate America, well, certainly I could do it for myself, right? And, well, unfortunately, it wasn't very much. That wasn't the case.
You ended up in $100,000 worth of debt just trying to get your business off the ground. What kind of business was it?
Yeah, it was a fashion jewelry and accessory company.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was trying to do everything. I was really playing, like, I was DIYing everything. I was buying every course and every program, and I thought I had to be an expert at this, and I wasn't really clear. And as a result, yeah, over $100,000 worth of debt, but we can stop there.
Wow. How did you turn that around?
I hired a mentor. Yeah, I hired a mentor, and I actually was at a conference. It was a 3-day event, and I stood up, and I was like, I need help. I have this vision, I have this passion, and I see it. I could see the success on the other side, but what my reality is right now, it's completely out of alignment. And how do I get there, you know? And so people had made recommendations to me, and the next week I was just doing a lot of research. Who can help me? And I found my mentor. And I knew right away because he had the mindset and the money game that I wanted to. He thought differently than I did, and he was super organized with his time, like productivity powerhouse. And I was like, oh, I got a lot to learn here.
So what did you change? What steps did he make you take that got you out of the hole you were in?
So interestingly enough, the first several months that we met, I cried after every session that we had.
Really?
Because it was so much change so quickly. But basically, I was able to overcome my own thoughts. So when you're in a space of having that $100,000 worth of debt, it's paralyzing. And so that was my main focus. I couldn't look forward and actually see where the company could go or what my own strengths, where they could get me, because I was so focused on my current reality.
Yeah, yeah. And how did you went from that to building a new business model, as I understand it, and making money?
Yes.
What's the new initiative?
Yeah. So I started mentoring women-owned businesses. I kind of stepped into my power. As a result of the work that we did together, I felt like I'm called to do something bigger. And I want to create community amongst women. That was the number one thing I wanted to do. Because I felt like if I could overcome myself and I could bring this story and share it with other women around the world and help them, just maybe even one person, overcome themselves, that this was powerful. And so I set out to create community. That was the first step. And then it kind of, a lot of people thought I was crazy, including my mentor. He was like, what? You're jumping ship from, you know, mm-hmm. a totally different business model to this? And I'm like, I'm being called to do this. You know, I need to do this. I need to make a difference in the world. It wasn't about money at all whatsoever. It was really about creating community. And I did that. And very quickly, my community started to grow. So that was really the first pieces. Kind of fell into this.
And now you are running a global business. Is that right?
Yeah. So I have clients in 12 countries. I've helped over 1,200 people this year alone help grow their businesses. It's awesome. It's incredible.
So you became a mentor after getting the life-saving help of a mentor.
I did.
You come full circle.
Yeah. It was totally totally by accident. Started working with people on the mindset, teaching them really how to overcome themselves on many levels. And then everything just kind of started to evolve from there.
You're going to be speaking tonight at the Treasury
in
downtown historic St. Augustine. It's their Women's Wednesday speaker series. What is your hope for the audience to come away with? What message?
I really want to inspire them to know that anything is possible. You know, if I can take myself from over $100,000 worth of debt into this very successful business model within a 2-year period, anyone can accomplish anything that they put their mind to.
And that's tonight.
That's
Stephanie Nikolich. What time is it?
5 p.m.
5 o'clock tonight. It's Women's Wednesdays at the Treasury. That's the old bank building turned event space in downtown St. Augustine. Come on out and see the Millionista Mentors speak. It is a fabulous speaker series, and there will be more excellent speakers through the summer. But Stephanie, it's a pleasure to meet you. You came up here from Miami for this, so we appreciate you doing that as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Jacksonville is seen as a religiously diverse city, but Christianity accounts for 94% of it. What about the other 6%? Hi, I'm Kyle Reese.
And I'm Nancy Bronner. Join us for WJCT's quarterly program, Faith Matters, as we explore what it means to be a religious minority in Jacksonville.
That's on Faith Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2. Sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Next time on The World, your online tutor for Arabic.
Most of my students call me Gays.
He's from Syria, a refugee with no way to earn a living until a startup hired him to teach.
I have around 30 students from USA, from England, from Pakistan, and most of them became my friends.
Learning online from refugees on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
All right, well, finally this hour, Theater Jacksonville brings the story of Ariel and her underseas adventures to the stage in Disney's The Little Mermaid. The classic debuts this Friday. Theater Jack's executive director, Sarah Boone, and costume designer, Kimberly Burns, are here. Good morning. And you've, good morning to
good
you
morning.
Both.
Good morning.
You've got on your Little Mermaid pants, I see.
Yes.
You're wearing pants that have Ariel on them. That is so cool.
I'm a big fan, and I always like to theme when I can.
Amazing. Okay, so that gives me a little window into this production. Tell us about this, Sarah. The Little Mermaid. I didn't know that people did this on stage.
Well, they do, and it is the movie come to life, so it's not the cartoon. We have real people on stage, and gosh, a lot of them. Our cast is big, and there's a lot of crew back there, and everything has been done here in Jacksonville.
Yeah, every parent listening has watched The Little Mermaid with their kids, especially if you have girls. I have two. How do you get Ariel and King Triton swimming, though, under the sea?
Well, that's the mystery that you find the answer to when you go see the show.
Ah, okay. And the costumes must be pretty incredible, because Sarah asked that I bring you into the studio to talk about them.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, we have a lot of costumes in this show. Like Sarah said, there's a large cast, and they're all a lot of different characters and creatures and under the sea things. So.
What about Ursula? How do you do Ursula? Because she's my favorite character in The Little Mermaid.
Should I give it away?
Yeah.
Or is that
she's like the evil octopus?
Well,
you know,
was that your hardest costume?
That was definitely a challenge. She's very large.
Yeah,
and she has many pieces and layers and things extending from her. So.
And you want kids to come with their parents to this,
absolutely,
right? This is a nice family show.
It is, yes. And we have special ticket pricing for kids 12 and under. and people are buying tickets, so it's exciting. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. What about the musical numbers? How much fun are those to work on? These are some really classic songs.
They are, and the songs that are in the movie are in the show.
Yes,
but they added some because there are not that many in the movie. So the Broadway team added, you know, more to the score. So
okay.
It's exciting. So you learn new songs as well as the old ones.
Wow. And it's interesting, too, that a lot of this happens with Ariel not speaking. So mm-hmm. that's got to be an acting challenge, too.
It is.
For your actress.
There is all kinds of creative things in the show.
That you don't want to give any of it away.
No.
I see. you're a sneaky one. Now I see how it is. All right. Well, it's got to be exciting, though. And this is great, too, for kids getting out for the summer. This is a nice weekend for kicking off the summer break and the summer season with this production.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's always good to get out and see a show and support your local theater.
And what else do you have on? Let me look at your whole outfit here.
Oh,
just the pants. Okay. I was looking for more Ariel-themed garb.
Well, I've got a little purple on top, too.
Oh, okay.
To kind of, you know,
right.
An ode to her seashells.
Did you buy those at Disney World?
Yes, I did. I frequent the parks. I'm a big fan
in general.
So I saw these after Sarah had asked me to do the show last year, and I figured... I'm usually working pretty hard at the theater, so I'd get some comfortable themed attire.
Very nice. We'll have to put those on Instagram as soon as possible.
Sure, yeah.
But in the meantime, go to theaterjax.com and get your tickets to The Little Mermaid, debuting Friday at Theater Jacksonville, the oldest community theater in Florida. Sarah Boone and costume designer Kimberly Burns, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Our podcasts are up every day at iTunes and Stitcher. Just subscribe or watch segments video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, voters cast ballots in California and five other states in the last big primary date of 2016. Analysis of results for both parties and what it all means for the general election. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be off tomorrow. The quarterly program, Faith Matters, will air tomorrow. Tune in for that, and we'll see you back here Friday morning. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.